In order to obtain a Chinese driver's license, Peter Hessler, the New Yorker magazine's Beijing correspondent, had to take a driving test with questions like this. If another motorist stops you to ask directions, you should A, not tell him, B, reply patiently and accurately, C, tell him the wrong way. But that didn't deter him from renting a car and driving 7,000 miles across northern China following the Great Wall. Peter Hessler was on our show back in February to discuss his book, Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory, which tells the stories of the desolate countryside of Inner Mongolia, a village's quick transition from a sleepy backwater into a tourist destination, and of a factory in the south that manufactures metal rings for bra straps. It's the third in his series of books about the changes taking place in China, and listeners told us how much they enjoyed our conversation, so we thought we would re-air it for you on this Memorial Day. I began by saying that for me, the image of China and traffic in China has always been all those bicycles in Beijing, and I asked Peter Hessler, has that pretty much disappeared?
No, it certainly hasn't disappeared, but there's a new element. I mean, when I moved to China, that was the way Beijing looked. And there's been a massive car boom over the last 10 years. And people still, you know, there are still many bicycles in Beijing, but we are seeing more and more cars. Beijing now has 4 million motor vehicles. I mean, it's a huge number.
On the cover of your book, we see a life-size ceramic figure of a policeman standing next to a long stretch of open highway. What's he doing there?
Yeah, this was in Inner Mongolia. I mean, the Chinese, you know, the country is sort of figuring these things out as they go. And one thing I realized when I started driving in China was you never see any cops. There's no road police. They didn't really know how to institute that, apparently, or they didn't want to devote resources to it. And so, and I was driving through Inner Mongolia, and their solution to this issue was to erect statues of cops.
Scarecrows.
Yeah. I called them terracotta cops in the book. And I see these things, and it's a cop, you know, full color, life size. He's standing on a pedestal beside the road. And I mean, you know, I live now in Colorado. I can't imagine how long you'd have one of those things there before somebody would shoot it, basically.
But do people pay attention?
No. It's not an effective form of traffic control.
What is driving like in China?
You know, it's sort of a, I guess it's directed chaos. I mean, it's, you know, people, you know, right now the country has about 138 million drivers, and 35% of them have less than 3 years' experience. You know, so this is just
sounds to me like it's dangerous.
Everybody's learning the same. It is dangerous, but you know, in the cities, it's low speed and the stakes are low as a result. And it's the mood is not that negative. I mean, I write in the book about how what happens if you have a little fender bender, which is very common, and you pull over and you negotiate with the other folks for the dent. You know, and it's generally pretty civil in that sense.
So there's no car insurance.
There is car insurance, but if you have a little dent, you know, they'll just pull over, and usually you start at 100 kwai, which was about $12 when I was there.
Well, you're based in Beijing, or were for 7 years as a New Yorker correspondent. Your book is mostly about what's happening outside the capital.
Yeah,
I mean, is that where the real story is taking place?
I think so, at least the stories that I was interested in. I mean, Beijing and Shanghai are great places, and, you know, exciting, interesting places, but I think they're not that representative of China. And the aspect of China that really did interest me deeply is this transition from the countryside to the city.
Well, in other books that have tried to address these stories, people have taken public transportation because they said that was also the way that they could meet the locals. What led you to decide to drive instead?
Well, you know, I was just interested in doing it. I wanted to take a long trip. One thing I realized once I was driving is I was driving this Jeep Cherokee that I had rented, and I had an empty passenger seat, and there were people beside the road looking for a ride. And so I picked up hitchhikers all across China, and that turned out to be a great way to learn about the place.
I read that question from the driving test. All of the questions seemed to have an obvious answer. Do people get them wrong?
No. I mean, it's a formality, basically, the written exam. It's not a difficult exam. The hardest part for them is the driving exam, because you have the written exam, and then you have to do a driving exam, and that's technical. It's actually quite difficult. Chinese people have to invest a lot of time. You're required to take a course with almost 60 hours of training before you can get a license. You have to pay for that yourself.
Now, you said you were driving a Jeep Cherokee. Weren't you worried that it might break down in a remote area? Do they have parts for Jeep Cherokees in some of the remoter parts of China?
They can get it done. I mean, I lost a, you know, I blew out a starter in Inner Mongolia, and, you know, it didn't take that long. We found a mechanic in Balto, the capital, and, you know, he's smoking a cigarette and you know, replacing the starter, and everything's fine. I mean, this is the way it goes in China.
You visited the Great Wall, as many tourists do, but you were visiting it differently?
Yeah, I mean, when I took this trip, I wanted to find a way to see rural China and to drive, but I wanted a variety. I didn't want to be on a highway. And so I thought, well, what's a good route across the north? And then, you know, the Great Wall basically goes across northern China, and I could see all different kinds of villages and roads. So I just followed the general route of the wall.
Is it one continuous wall?
Certainly not. No, I mean, there's many sections built at many times, but there are general zones where there's wall, and you can often you can drive along a stretch of it for, you know, 10 or more miles. So, you know, and it's marked on maps, so that was basically my route.
Now, why the gaps? If a wall is erected to protect an area, gaps are an invitation for people to rush through that part.
Well, you know, they would leave the gaps in areas where people were less likely to come through, you know, and there has generally been a sense that the wall was ineffective. This has been what historians believe. But, you know, really, in recent years, there's been one historian in particular, David Spindler, an American guy, who's done the best research on the Great Wall. And he's found that, you know, it was a very functional defense work. And it was combined with diplomacy. It was combined with trade. I mean, it was part of a whole system of foreign policy to manage this issue of the Northerners.
And it was also a symbol that we're going to protect ourselves.
Yeah, although I think the symbolic aspect of the wall is really a modern incarnation. It's in our generation that we see the wall as a symbol for China. I think for the Ming Dynasty, they saw it mostly as functional.
My guest is Peter Hessler, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he served as the Beijing correspondent from 2000 to 2007. He's also contributed to the National Geographic. And his latest book is called Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory. It's published by Harper's. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You speak Mandarin fluently, don't you?
Yes, I learned it there in China.
Does that put you under any suspicion? Aren't there certain rules that foreign journalists are expected to follow in China?
There are rules for journalists, and in this project I didn't really follow the rules, but most people don't nowadays. And I mean, there are lots of things for the Chinese government to worry about. You know, it's a big country with a lot of issues, and I don't think I'm very high on the list. There was never any indication. And it's for a trip like this, you know, I was basically, you know, I wasn't supposed to do it technically, but I didn't have big problems.
Well, if they want to pick on you, they can arrest you and say you were spying, and we've seen that happen. I guess if you were Chinese, even if you had an American passport, you would have been under more suspicion.
Yeah, you know, and again, you know, who's watching you is the issue. And you mentioned the cover of the book is a statue of a cop beside a road. And I mean, a lot of times that's the way it felt. I didn't have a lot of interaction with the authorities.
Did you introduce yourself as a journalist?
Certainly, yeah.
Were not cautious?
Most people were very open. I mean, and one thing I did do to be careful is I camped often. I brought a tent. Because one thing in China is that if you stay at a hotel and you register, then they often will tell the police a foreign journalist is in town. And so I try to avoid that. But, you know, people are more and more open in China. I think it's a pretty easy place to talk to folks.
One of the things that you wrote that surprised me, because it goes against everything I've been hearing about the current situation in China, is you say, long-time planning made no sense. The goal was gain some profit today before you found yourself overwhelmed by the next wave of change.
Right. And this is the perspective of the average Chinese. I mean, I think the average person has lived in a climate of extreme change and unpredictability for a long time. And there has been a general trajectory to the country, but policies and approaches have shifted a lot over 20 years. The average Chinese person has become quite fluid, quite flexible.
So they're working things out as they go along?
The people do that. I mean, the government has longer-term plans, and, you know, and they do what they can to enact those.
Can you give me an example of how that works on a personal level?
Well, you know, the second part of this book is about a village north of Beijing. The first part is a long driving trip. And after that, I kind of wanted to focus on a place and see what happens in a place. And they paved a new road to the village in 2002. And when you have a new road that's paved for the first time, things change, and you know, people can go to and from the city, new goods begin to appear. And you know, what I'm tracking in this book is how people respond, and they responded very quickly. I mean, the locals learned to do business. They learned to set up restaurants and guest houses. They learned to sell their crops at market rates instead of just to whoever, you know, happened to come through to buy.
So this is the town of Sancha?
Yeah, the village of Sancha.
You actually rented a house there?
Yeah, I rented a house there starting in 2001. I still have a house there now.
And it's changed totally because of the highways?
The main thing that changed this place, when I went there first, it was a dirt road that went to the village. It was a dead-end road, and it took more than 2 hours from Beijing.
And it was a backwater?
Oh, certainly, certainly. You know, it's just beyond the Great Wall. And, you know, they paved the road, and Beijing had a car boom. And those two elements meant huge changes, both because villagers could go to the city, but more importantly, people from the city could go to the village.
You struck up a friendship with a 5-year-old boy in Sancha. Do you feel that people were more trusting with their children than in the United States?
Well, there's no question. I mean, there's a section on the drive I went across China where I pulled into a village, really tiny place, you know, very, very close to the Inner Mongolian border. And I was asking for directions because I'd heard there were some beautiful sections of the Great Wall nearby. And an old man, you know, tried to give me directions, couldn't really communicate. And he said, oh, here, just take my grandson. And the kid jumps in the car, and all of his friends jump in. And before I knew it, I have 6 kids in the car. This old guy didn't ask me my name, what I'm doing, and I drive off with all these children to look at the Great Wall. So people are generally in the north, and especially in the countryside, tend to be quite trusting. I mean, it was one of the things I liked about this experience was the openness.
What about growing up in a country that's changing so rapidly? This kid, he's only 5 years old, and I'm sure everything he remembers has already changed.
Yeah, I mean, for him, it's just the only world he's known. I mean, he's now about a 7th grader, but he was, you know, when I first met them, I mean, it was a very, you know, they didn't make a lot of money. The village was quite poor generally, and now the family is quite affluent. You
know? What was the village doing before the road came?
Strictly farming. Mm-hmm. You know, they farmed walnuts, apricots, you know, just sort of basic crops, and they would make a little bit of surplus, but not that much.
A few months ago, the sociologist Peter Carr visited our show to talk about the population drain away from rural areas in the United States, especially with young people. Shouldn't I assume the same sort of thing is happening in China, even in towns like Sancha?
Oh, certainly. I mean, when I moved to Sancha, the population was about 150, and it had been 300, you know, 10, 15 years earlier. So and when I drove across China, that was usually the story I heard, that the populations had dropped by about 50% often.
Are children being left with their grandparents while their parents go off to the city to seek employment?
Yeah, that's the way it works. I mean, you know, as a whole, China has about 140 million migrants, you know, people who've left the countryside. And so, you know, especially in these more remote areas, the people that you see there are not of working age. You see older people, you might see disabled people, and you see a lot of children who are being raised. And as far as the future of these places, it's very hard to see.
Wasn't there a time when you needed a pass to go into one of the cities?
Yeah, that was even before my time. I mean, I started in China in 1996. You know, now the Chinese, for the Chinese citizens, yeah, there was a registration system where they had to be registered in their hometown, and it was hard for them to leave. That has really changed. That's been opened up, and now it's basically very easy for somebody to move elsewhere.
You mentioned Inner Mongolia. Inner Mongolia is the part of Mongolia that remained with China, while Outer Mongolia went with the Soviet Union. I don't know. I think it's independent now,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. Mongolia proper is, you know, is an independent country.
Are they very different?
Well, they're different in the sense that Inner Mongolia does not have very many Mongolians in it anymore. I mean, the percentage is much lower. I mean, basically, Inner Mongolia sounds very remote, but it's actually not that far from Beijing. And so during the Cultural Revolution and during many of these political campaigns, the Chinese moved large numbers of ethnic Chinese into that area. So.
Well, since the Mongolians invaded China and ruled it for many years, is that something that lingers as a memory? In Mongolia, you visited the mausoleum of Genghis Khan. I would assume that he would not be seen as a totally positive figure by the Chinese.
You would think so. You know, I went to that mausoleum is in China, in Inner Mongolia, and it's, you know, a celebration of Genghis Khan. And you look at the displays, and they're all about how Genghis Khan improved the economy and how he cared about global trade. And so they're sort of putting a very contemporary Deng Xiaoping spin on Genghis Khan. And you read the English says, you know, Genghis Khan was a great Mongol leader. And you read the Chinese and it says Genghis Khan was a great Chinese leader. So the Chinese have sort of, you know, trying to take control of this legacy, which, of course, makes Mongolians very angry.
And the whole Manchu history has been totally papered over?
People are aware of the Manchus. There's not, you know, it's hard to find an ethnic Manchu. The language has basically died out. You know, that's not really an element so much of Chinese life anymore.
My guest is Peter Hessler of The New Yorker, also National Geographic. His latest book, Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory, published by Harper's. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. I hope you can join me on Tuesday, June 15th at 7 p.m. in WNYC's Jerome L. Green Space. We'll have a cook-off with chefs Jacques Pepin and Michelle Nichan. La Bernardin sommelier Aldo Somme will go toe-to-toe with audience members in a blind wine taste test. Plus, cellist Sarah Santambrogio of the Eroica Trio performs live. For more information and tickets, visit wnyc.org/thegreenspace. That's green with an E at the end. And I hope to see you there. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with an interview I did in February with Peter Hessler of The New Yorker when he was on our show to discuss his book, Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory. One of the things we talked about was whether the roads have brought tourist business to sleepy towns like Sanzhou. And I asked him, is tourism a growing business of the future?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the middle class Chinese have been able to buy cars and they have disposable income. And one of the first things that they like to do is to explore their country to some degree. So you do see more and more Chinese who are going on the road. You
know? And what are they looking for in a town like Sanzhou?
Well, yeah, this is north of Beijing. And just like any city person, I mean, especially a city person who lives in a city with 13 million people, they're looking for peace and quiet of some sort, you know, something different. And they're there. The Great Wall is nearby. But a lot of it is just to, you know, be somewhere outside of the city life.
Is this explosion in car ownership a government policy? Because in 2003, Chinese car sales increased by 80%. That suddenly an awful lot of cars. In the past, weren't people restricted from owning cars?
You know, the main restriction was basically economic. People couldn't afford it. But it is true that the government has pushed the industry. They've tried to make it easy for people to buy cars. And, you know, we've seen an explosion. It was 2 million you know, cars produced in 2001, and last year they produced 13 million. I mean, it's just, you know, a huge, huge change.
So they're driving Chinese-made cars?
Yeah, I mean,
but you wound up with a Jeep Cherokee. Why?
Initially in China, most of the cars came out of joint ventures. So they invited GM, Volkswagen, AMC. Foreign car makers could come to China and set up a joint venture with, you know, with local Chinese manufacturers. But now we are seeing more Chinese companies that have an impact in the market.
You seem to paint a China of two extremes, peasants who wear army surplus clothes and raise their children on the farm, and urbanites with fat, spoiled children. There's little in between?
Well, what's in between is movement. And I think the thing to realize with China is that we do have these very different worlds, urban and rural, but there's not a line between them. People are crossing this line. Of course, they're moving in one direction. They're moving from the countryside to the cities, and they make this transition. Wei Jiqi, the farmer I write about, he makes this transition over the course of the 7 years that I know him. And that transition involves things like his dress. He became very conscious of how he looked. He would have certain clothes he'd wear in the city. It, you know, changed the way he talked. He began to smoke, for example, like people in the city do. So people are making this shift. So that's where that's a connection.
What about cultural attitudes? I've seen documentaries that involve young women who've gone to the city, gotten jobs, and when they've gone back home, they suddenly are faced with the old-fashioned values. Maybe the family wants them to marry some local boy, and they now have big city attitudes about who you might get married to.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what happens. You go to the city and you cannot come back generally, you know, and people have this struggle. My wife is a writer and her book, Factory Girls, talks about this. She went back to the villages with girls.
In fact, it was that book And there was also a film along the same lines that I was thinking about.
Yeah,
just
you see this all the time, and when people come back, they realize they can't, basically.
Well, there's a lot of contrast between the city and the provinces. For example, Chinese food is quite regional, but apparently regional Chinese cuisines in Beijing are drastically different from the food that you get in the region.
Yeah, I mean, Beijing, basically, I mean, it's a great city for eating. There's great restaurants in Beijing. But, you know, they had to create a lot of cuisines because this is a place that for many years you didn't have a middle class and upper class who would consume these. And so when I moved to Beijing, I'd go to high-end Sichuanese restaurants, and I lived in Sichuan for 2 years in the Peace Corps, and the dishes they would have would be totally different from anything I ever saw in Sichuan, you know, because they're innovating these. You know, in the village where I have a home, their specialty became trout, and they had never had trout before. They actually came from Swiss stock.
Isn't this partly the result of what happened during the Cultural Revolution? First, the early days of the revolution, the Cultural Revolution, where most of the people who really knew how to cook the regional cuisine were forced to leave because they had been connected to the rulers.
I think the issue
there was suddenly this influx. We started having Hunanese and Sichuanese restaurants in this country because people had been chased out of China.
I think the main issue is basically economic. I mean, if you don't have a free market and people don't have money to spend, then there's no point in having a sophisticated cuisine. And so restaurants, there were very few restaurants. You talk to people who were in China in the 80s, there wasn't much choice, you know. And so once the economy changed and there was a market for it, it came back.
You know? Also, if you were assured of having a job, it didn't matter whether you cooked well or not.
Of course, yeah.
You wrote that a woman with little education might have an advantage over a male in getting ahead in a factory setting in China.
Yeah, factory jobs are often more welcoming to women. If you talk to factory managers and ask them who they want to hire, they usually are going to say women, and you ask them why, and they say, well, they're more obedient, and they'll do what I tell them, and they work harder. That's what they say.
So does that mean that young women are leaving the rural areas, leaving the males behind?
No, because the males have opportunities, too, in terms of, you know, males often work on construction crews or they work as security guards. And there are factory jobs that depend on males, especially anything that involves lifting or machinery. Those jobs tend to be. But, you know, for the sort of the basic assembly line work is dominated by women.
Isn't there a glut of males right now in China because of the one-child policy?
Well, they say there's a glut of there's going to be way too many males. But, you know, it hasn't really hit marrying age yet. So that change is happening. I mean, basically, there's been 119 boys born for every 100 girls, as far as they can tell. It's very hard to get good statistics on this sort of thing.
How strictly is the one-child policy being enforced in China? Is it different in the cities and the rural areas?
Yeah, I mean, it's not really the one-child policy. That's what we call it, but it's the Chinese phrase is planned birth policy, and basically, it varies a lot by region. The village where I lived and where I had a home, the people there, if they had a girl first, they could have another child. You know, so people there could legally have two. And you find this as you travel around China. There are very different rules for different places. Enforcement is also varies much by region. So I went to some towns where I'd see three boys, and I'd say, well, how did they do that? And they're like, well, you know, we just paid the local officials some money. So it's, you know, like everything in China, there are rules, and then there are people who are finding their ways around them.
And aren't some minorities exempted from the policy?
Minorities?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, that's true. If you're in a Tibetan area or a Uyghur or you know, if you're Mongolian, often the rules. And they can be very, very detailed. I mean, I was in one place where Kazakhs had a certain number and Mongolians had a certain number and Chinese had a certain number that they're allowed to have.
Well, China is so vast, it seems to me it would be really difficult to rule it from a capital city, or rule it with any efficiency. So how much are the local leadership relied on to enforce the rules that Beijing sends out?
Enormously. I mean, this is one thing that's happened a lot in China over the past 10 years is we see a lot of, you know, a lot of regionalization and you know, not only in terms of enforcement, but also in terms of raising their funds. I mean, the third section of this book, I'm in a factory town, and one of the issues I look at is, well, where does this town get their funding? Are they getting huge amounts of money from the central government? That's not the case. You know, the government does not support every city in China to the degree that they need. And so they have to find their own ways to raise cash.
A part of the transition, economic transition, has been in balancing government-owned industries with the new entrepreneurially created industries.
Yeah, I mean,
how are they working it out?
Well, they basically have tried to transition as many of those state-owned companies to private as they can. I mean, the general preference has been for the private market to take over.
When you were picking up the hitchhikers, what did they tell you? A listener, George from Bay Ridge, asks, what do people in China think about the outside world, about democracy or America? How did they feel about the Chinese Communist Party?
Yeah, I mean, the picking up the hitchhikers often, I mean, I was in very remote areas, and it sometimes took them a while to register that I was a foreigner. Sometimes people would ask me if I was Mongolian or Uyghur, because they're not used to having a foreigner drive through in a car.
And they didn't know what a Uyghur looked like.
I guess not, because they thought I was a Uyghur. You know, people's questions, they often ask economic-oriented questions. They'll ask you how much money you make, or, you know, sometimes they'll ask you how many children you can have. They don't ask so much big-picture questions if you're talking to somebody who's an average Chinese. You know, their interests are more practical, and they want to know what practical life is for you as well.
Mm-hmm. And they're not curious about life in America?
They're very curious. They're very curious. But the details that they're curious about are, you know, how much does this cost there? You know, is it easy to get a car there? I heard everybody has a car. Is that true? Questions like that.
When you read analysis of what's going on in China, the growing superpower, the growing economic superpower, the tensions between the United States and China over currency rates and such, does that jibe with your personal experience?
Well, I mean, I was writing a lot about average people in China, and I'm writing about these people from the countryside who moved to the city. And for them, those issues are really not that relevant, you know. And I think we tend to get very extreme views. I mean, China is a threat, or China is going to take over the world. And, I sort of have a tempered view of all that. Because when you live on the ground, you realize that there's a lot of stuff there that has to be worked out. You know, it's a pretty chaotic place in many ways.
Well, I remember seeing films that were made in the old days in China, where you had a sense that people's lives were really very closely regulated. They couldn't do anything without going to the local boss, whoever that was. And you get the feeling that all of that has fallen apart today. How do people make that transition from spying on their neighbors to suddenly having no need to spy on their neighbors?
Well, I think they're relieved to see it gone. I mean, the people don't, you know, they like to have the freedom of movement, the freedom to find their own jobs, and that's where they're at now. So people have responded with a lot of energy. You know, this is a very motivated population. They're willing to make, you know, to make big moves and to make decisions and to change their lives, and that's what we've seen for the last 10 years.
My guest is Peter Hessler of The New Yorker. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he served as the Beijing correspondent from 2000 to 2007. He's also a contributing writer for National Geographic, and the author of Rivertown, which won the Kiriyama Book Prize, also Oracle Bones, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. His latest is called Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory. It's published by Harper's. In the last part of your book, you travel to Zhejiang province. Did I say it right?
Yeah, Zhejiang, yeah.
That's a major manufacturing area in the south?
Yeah, that's one of the coastal region south of Shanghai, and it's a, you know, big factory district basically.
And how do these districts become big manufacturing districts? There's another one. I understand the one outside of Hong Kong in what used to be called Canton, right? Shandong. But why the area near Shanghai?
Well, you know, these places develop in different ways. Some of the ones down near Hong Kong, like Shenzhen, was a government project where they prepared infrastructure and set up rules to draw, you know, investment. The place I was looking at in southern Zhejiang, it's happened basically because the people there have a tradition of entrepreneurism. And that tradition predated the communists by a long time, and it survived communism. They weren't allowed to do business. But once they were allowed, and after 1978, the reforms began, people responded very quickly, and they could set up businesses on their own with very low capital. So this is a place where they produce very simple things, but they do it incredibly cheaply and effectively. So, and often you have a town that makes one huge product. Like you go through a place called Chaotou, and that makes most of the buttons for clothes made in China. It's, you know, they call it Button Town, and you go there, and there's a big statue of a button in the center of town.
There was a documentary a few years back which started off with this long shot of the camera going across the factory, and it must have taken 10 minutes for it to go from one side to the other. We're talking about some pretty huge buildings, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, there are massive factories. This area that I was in is actually often it's very small because it's family run and low investment, you know. And so you go into a place and there's dozens, even hundreds. I mean, in that town I just mentioned, they had 380 factories that were making buttons, you know. So often these factories are just workshops, you know, maybe a dozen workers.
There's been a lot of concern lately about the safety of products that are made in China, both here and in China. Is what you left before the scandals with the milk?
Yeah. I mean, but it's not a surprise if you've spent time in Chinese factories. I mean, it's you know, people cut corners. I mean, I write in this book about these two entrepreneurs, and they're setting up their factory, and I was with them on the day that they designed the interior of their plant. They toured these three stories of an empty building and drew up their blueprints, and they did that in 64 minutes, you know, for three stories, 24,000 square foot. I mean, they're just flying through. So there's not a lot of, you know, the quality management is not always the emphasis.
But adulterating milk, which will be drunk by children, that's something you have to cross over a line to do that sort of thing.
Obviously, yeah. I mean, that's not
it happens everywhere, but it seems to happen a lot in China.
Yeah, I mean, it's a place where people, again, it comes down to long-term thinking, you know, often. I mean, often the long-term perception is lacking, and that's a classic situation where this was not in anybody's best interest. It wasn't in the company's best interest, and the people who did that got in trouble.
What were the working conditions like in the places you visited?
They range widely. The factory town that I was working in, the people there made about 40 cents an hour, which is decent wage for you know, an uneducated worker in China. And I think that, you know, you find some factories where the conditions would be dangerous. A lot of this is very light industry. So the factory that I really looked at, was they were just making a very simple product. And so the conditions were basically tolerable.
Was 40 cents an hour a good wage compared to what you might have found in a town like Sancha?
Yeah, it's all a matter of perspective. It's a good wage for somebody who's farming, basically. And so in China right now, you still have about 10 million people leaving the countryside every year. And for them, you know, they start at this lower level, but they're not happy there after a certain amount of time. And, you know, people have a lot of mobility within that world. They find ways to get the better jobs. And so, you know, 40 cents an hour sounds awful to us. It's not a bad starting point for somebody from the countryside.
You wrote that living in China had a way of making you feel slow-witted. How so?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it brought out my true character. But they, you know, one thing, as a foreigner, there's a lot you don't understand, and you're speaking a foreign language. But
you knew you speak rather fluently. I think you admit to not knowing one medical term at one point.
Oh, there's plenty that I don't know, you know. But you figure this stuff out as you go along. I mean, I think the emphasis really is that people are very fast. You know, people respond very quickly in China, and they react very quickly. You know, and so you become accustomed to this sort of pace, and it's not the pace at which I naturally do things.
Also, were people surprised that you? You knew certain things? I know when I lived in Chinatown, sometimes I would say something in Cantonese, and a common reaction was the equivalent of, wow, the monkey can talk. You know, and they were so surprised that a stupid person like me would actually know some Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, you go to remote parts of China and they would be shocked. But, you know, it depends on where you are. And Beijing has a huge number of foreigners who speak Chinese, and sometimes they get in a cab and they're like, oh, I just had another foreigner whose Chinese is much better than yours. So, you know, it depends on where you are, basically.
Do you have a favorite anecdote from the book?
I guess I really enjoyed the drive, and I liked picking up people. I liked picking up the
hitchhikers. But driving all of those miles, that had to be wearing as well.
Yeah, you know, but I had a lot of time. I mean, basically, I structured this with complete freedom, and that was the pleasure of the trip. I had no deadline. There was no goal. I was just, you know, driving my way west.
Well, here you are now in Colorado after 7 years in China. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you speak Coloradoese as well as you speak Mandarin, but don't you think you're going to miss it a little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, we might be moving on again, but no, we moved from, my wife and I moved from Beijing, you know, a city of 13 million to a town called Ridgeway, which has about 700 people, you know. So we wanted the shock therapy transition, I guess.
That's like going back to Sancha, isn't it?
It's very similar. I mean, I wanted a couple years quiet, and that gave me a great place to write this book.
The book is called Country Driving, A Journey Through China from Farm to Factory. It's published by Harper. Do you have another book in the works?
Not right now. I'm working on some magazine pieces, but eventually we'll get there.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thanks so much.